Talks with... This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Story Dance Theater of Harlem is about to have a very big presence in Charlotte. First, they're performing here this weekend, weather permitting, at the Knight Theater and across the street at the Harvey B. Gantt Center, an exhibit focusing on the company and its artistic and cultural contributions opens today and runs through June. We're going to hear about that and meet the artistic director of the Dance Theater of Harlem later in the program. First, a different story about the contributions of African Americans. This true story finds its way to the light in a novel called Wherever There Is Light by Peter Golden. Mr. Golden is an award-winning journalist and historian, but he turned to fiction to tell the real story of the contribution of African American colleges and their role in helping rescue German Jewish professors from Hitler's killing machine in the 1930s and 40s. Peter Golden joins us now in our Spirit Score studio. Welcome. You braved the storm, did you?
Yes, I did. Good morning, Mike.
Nice to have you here. By the way, Peter Golden is supposed to be signing his book this afternoon at 1:30 at Park Road Books in the Park Road Shopping Center. We do not know yet whether that event will take place, but you can check with Park Road Books to find out, to make sure. You are, as I said, an award-winning journalist, a Cold War historian. In the course of covering the Cold War, you've written the biography. You've interviewed Presidents Reagan. Who came next?
Nixon or Ford. George H.W. Bush, yeah. Gorbachev, Kissinger, yeah.
You've written the biography. You've written your own memoir. You've written books and articles about various different periods of history. And you are a novelist. So why your interest in novels? And why did you choose the setting of a novel to tell this true story about African-American colleges?
Well, the first novel that I published had to do with – I was writing a Cold War history at the time, and I had just interviewed Gorbachev. I came home, and I was trying to think of the one thing, the most potent change in the United States since World War II. And I came up with the changing role of women, which sort of turned society upside down. And I wrote a book called – a novel – about it very quickly, called Come Back Love, which is about that issue. And that novel did okay. And I'd always wanted to tell this story, but I didn't know exactly how I was going to do it. And so I had these characters in mind. One was a former bootlegger. His name is Julian Rose. And the other is a woman who becomes a very successful photographer by the name of Kendall Wakefield. And the question for me was, how are they going to meet? And I figured it out by this one little facet of history that I explored years ago. I had read this very small book written by a woman who clearly didn't – English was not her first language. I tracked her down. This was prior to the internet, and it was hard. I found her in Washington, D.C. I waited outside her apartment building to talk to her. I tried to call her. I couldn't get her on the phone. And a woman came out, and I asked about her, and she said she had been in hospice and she had passed away. So I was sort of very curious about what happened – when these white professors and their families showed up at these African-American universities at a time when segregation was so strict they didn't bury whites and blacks in the same graveyard, which, of course, I always found rather amusing since ultimately everybody would be the same color. But anyway, so what happened when they got down there? And I couldn't find out because the woman who would have told me was no longer here.
Yeah.
And so I invented these scenarios based on my research, and that's where the book came from.
So the fact that these African-American colleges played this role in the 1930s and 40s of rescuing at least some German Jewish professors, it's fairly unknown. Even you say that you don't understand how you missed this story. Why has this been lost to history? Why has it been buried in the mists of history?
It's a really interesting question. First of all, to start with, bringing people into this country during the 1930s and early 1940s was not popular. So nobody was going to be advertising that.
And it was not popular for a number of reasons, least of which is the Great Depression. There were no jobs for people already here.
Right. And it was particularly unpopular to bring Jews in, particularly German Jews, because first of all, people were worried about spies.
Okay.
So that was the first thing. Secondly, to get involved in what was going on in Nazi Germany made it appear like we were being dragged into this war that, understandably, Americans really didn't want to get into. Having fought World War I, having lost over 100,000 people in a year, of less than a year of fighting, actually, people didn't want any part of this. So Roosevelt was very cagey about these things. Lend-Lease was a way to convert factories without scaring everybody. He knew what was going to happen, but you turn an auto plant into making tanks and planes, people are going to get really scared. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't advertised. I think by the time the story played out, there was real animosity between the two groups. The Jews had been deeply involved in the civil rights movement. And as the civil rights movement fragmented into far left and to sort of moderate, the far left became very vocal in criticizing Israel, which, of course, annoyed all of these Jews who had been involved in both helping Israel and in the civil rights movement. So I think there was some animosity. And it wasn't a huge number. It was just in the hundreds. But I still think it's really important. And I wish people talked about it more. The other thing that's in this book, and I think this has been underreported, were the very wealthy African-American families in this country and the contribution they made to the civil rights movement, to colleges, to all kinds of things that they haven't been given credit for. And there are numbers of them. And so in this book, the Wakefields are one of those families in which they found this college and they pay for it. They give scholarships to half the students. And so I wanted to explore that as well.
And you say that the story of this rescue of German Jewish professors by these African American colleges, which is at the heart of your novel, and is in fact a true story, is an example of history striking people as they live through their lives. But we're all living through history every single day. Do you think that if people understood that, they'd pay more attention to what's going on around them?
I do. I that's a wonderful point, Mike. I think also we have fragmented as a culture. We're much more interested in opinions than we are in trying to figure out what's actually going on. So, for example, if you were to tune in one news channel, the president's never done anything right. Tune in the other one, he's never done anything wrong. History doesn't play out that way. History is just this wonderful multiple shades of gray. And people are not usually comfortable. People want right, wrong answers now. It takes time, and people should be a little more measured in their approach. But that, of course, is the opposite of what's going on in this country.
Interesting you should talk about the media, because you're right about the media's role in all of this. And you mentioned that at this time, while the New York Times was burying stories about concentration camps, smaller African-American papers, and you call out the Pittsburgh Courier, which was a big African-American right. newspaper at the time, may still be, I don't know, they were running cartoons of Hitler's persecution of the Jews. And it was the African-American press that was sounding the alarm about Hitler's persecution of the Jews, correct?
That's a wonderful point. In fact, it has a lot of relevance today. What was going on at the time is people were looking at what Hitler was doing tactically. He was increasing his armed forces. He was grabbing land, and Churchill was talking about that. There were only two entities that were really hyper-focused on his ideology. And one of them was Stalin, interestingly mm-hmm. enough, who, when he read Mein Kampf, said, "This guy's serious. He wants to do these things." And he saw him as a murderous ideologue, which, of course, Stalin would, because Stalin was one as well.
Takes one to know
right.
one.
Right. And the African-American press, who were focused on anti-lynching legislation at the time, and what they saw was what Hitler was doing was a result of ideology. It wasn't a tactic. It was something about the way he viewed the world. And that's what was dangerous. And if you hear our discussions of ISIS, this should be obvious to people by now. It's not exactly what they're doing that's so dangerous, which it is, but it's their ideology. Al-Qaeda had the same ideology. As you see, it just gets passed along. So this is really an issue. In America, we tend generally not to take these kind of wacky ideologues seriously. Thus, we have Charlie Chaplin making fun of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
But in the long run, it didn't prove to be so funny.
What was it about? Was it simply that African Americans were accustomed to persecution, so they could recognize it when they saw it, and that's what got them up in arms?
It wasn't just persecution. In other words, it wasn't just the Jim Crow laws. Uh-huh. I mean, and they had plenty of sort of Jim Crow laws applied to Jews in Germany. It was the violence. At the time, you have to remember what was going on was anti-lynch. They were pushing for federal anti-lynching legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw the connection between lynching and ideology. And that's where that connection came. It wasn't just the prejudice. It wasn't just that these Jews lost their jobs in Germany. It was that what was getting ready to happen. And they saw that very clearly because they saw the ideology is dangerous, not just what Hitler was doing tactically.
Now, this is a novel.
Right.
But this is a true story at the heart of the novel. And I know that you did research into this as much as possible to figure out what really happened. So why... How did African-American colleges first find out about the need for them to help rescue these German professors? And how did it happen? Because it wasn't easy.
Oh, my. I don't believe I have the whole story, but I'll just give you a little bit. There has always been a connection between Jews and African-Americans and education. If you remember Rosenwald...
Well, we just did a show not too long about the Rosenwald schools. Julius Rosenwald was the head of Sears Roebuck in the early 20th century, and he was a philanthropist and built hundreds of schools for African Americans in parts of the country where they wouldn't have had any schools if it weren't for him.
And he also got on the board of Tuskegee Institute.
Right.
He was very friendly with Booker T. Washington.
Okay.
I believe they were involved, although I have never been able to show that. We know the Rockefeller Foundation provided some money. But this I can tell you from my experience about writing all sorts of other things that touch on the subject of moving people, particularly Jews. I've written quite a bit about the Soviet Jewry movement. People don't advertise what they do. To move people, particularly in countries that are sort of mixed about letting them leave, there's probably a fair amount of bribery that's going on. We don't know about that. At one point, American Jews and other Jewish groups tried to buy the Jews out of Nazi Germany. Hmm. I mean, we don't know how all of this happened. We know officially the Rockefeller Foundation started. We know there was a connection between Jewish organizations and African-American schools. But beyond that, we don't know a lot.
But I would take it that much of the movement of these German-Jewish professors to these African-American colleges had to take place in the 1930s because the exit doors in Germany slammed shut
pretty quickly. Right.
How many did they bring in? Collectively, do we know?
I don't know. I mean, it's in the hundreds that I know of.
Uh-huh.
But there could have been more, and they're gone now.
Were they allowed to bring their families in?
They did bring their families.
Brought their families in.
Absolutely.
It was the Depression. These were African-American schools.
Right.
They didn't have a lot of money to begin with,
right.
And it was the Depression. Nobody had any money.
Somebody was funding this beyond the Rockefeller Foundation. I don't know where they got the money.
Well, these schools that did it, they have no historical records of who they brought in and where the money came in to support. Because they employed these people. Once they brought them here, they let them teach.
Right, but how they actually got the visas to do that, I suspect the State Department was involved in this. I mean, again, I know a lot about this from the Soviet Jewry side.
Okay.
And it's done in the dark. People moving, particularly of oppressed people, especially oppressed Jews. And now you're talking about a country where anti-Semitic attitudes were prevalent, where racist attitudes were prevalent. I mean, this was so outrageous what they managed to do.
Yeah.
The quickest way to avoid getting in trouble is not to have a record. I mean, part of what goes on in modern life, which is so different from the past, is there's a record of everything.
Of everything, yeah. But back then you could...
Peter
Golden is our guest in this segment. Peter Golden's a journalist and historian and a novelist. His new novel is called Wherever There Is Light, and it's about the importation of German Jewish professors by African American colleges. They left one form of persecution to find another. We'll talk about that when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC Charlotte Executive Education. Coming soon, a program for senior managers and leaders entitled Innovation and Growth is Everyone's Business. Details at exec-ed.uncc.edu. Monday on this program, we have a listener roundtable of folks talking about the politics and the election. This is in cooperation with NPR. We've had a balanced profile of people coming to our table on Monday. Two independents, a Democrat, a Republican, and we'll be talking about the presidential election campaign. And some of them may appear on NPR shows later on in the week as a result of this collaborative effort. That's Monday morning at 9. Our guest today in this hour, well, he was supposed to appear at Park Road Books at 1:30. 9:30 today to sign his book. That may happen, check with Park Grove Books, but he will not be at Great Expectations in Rutherfordton or at the Pines in Davidson for the Women's National Book Association. We're coming right back.
This afternoon, let's go somewhere.
We begin the program in Paris, which is...
And then over in East Africa, you have a
series of raids throughout Brussels and other cities.
The first Saudi women to vote, celebrated with hugs and...
As airports go, Concord Regional is still young at 21 years old. The city of Concord built it to...
All Things Considered takes you around the world and back in minutes. Listen, every afternoon.
All Things Considered, weekday afternoons beginning at 4 on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Coming up, the Dance Theater of Harlem, but we're talking right now to Peter Golden, who is a journalist, historian, and novelist. His latest book is called Wherever There Is Light, and at the core of that story is a little-known true story of the role of African-American colleges in the 1930s and 40s, bringing in German-Jewish professors from Nazi Germany. I said before the break that they traded one form of persecution for another. They were facing probably, they didn't know it at the time, but they were facing certain death had they stayed behind in Germany if Hitler was going to be successful. But when they came here, they ran into a kind of oppression not even they understood. Talk about that.
Well, Micah, that's the part that's unclear, and that's to some degree that's what I was after when I went to speak with that woman who, and it turned out that she had passed away. Yes, they did, but this doesn't get a lot clearer until the 1950s and 1960s. The point I was trying to make is that the roots of the civil rights movement, what we think of as a civil rights movement that is so associated with Dr. King and Rosa Parks, really starts in the run-up to World War II. It starts with these African-American presses. You mentioned the Pittsburgh Courier. They had something called the Double V campaign. That was victory over fascism abroad, victory over racism at home, and they had pins that people wore that were these double Vs.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start to see this kind of thing, and this melding of African-Americans and Jews. If you remember the bombings that went on, and we talk a lot about the churches, I believe there were over 50 synagogues that were bombed during the civil rights movement as well. So there was always this association of the two groups.
Well, it's problematic for the German Jews because they're all white. But there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the country, as you said. There was a lot of anti-Semitism within academia at the time. And they come over here and they go to places in the Deep South, these African-American colleges in the Deep South like Mississippi, where if a white person and a black person had to meet in a private home, you had to pull the shades.
Right. Right.
So how could they teach in that environment? And they didn't understand the racism when they arrived. They didn't get it.
I think they were pretty much left alone. They were what I could tell about it is that students really liked them, because you have to understand these were African American students who, if they had anything to do with white people, it was a very unequal relationship. Here you have these very formal German professors who were treating everybody the same. So it must have been a revelation for many of these students to be treated that way. Oh. by these professors.
And I read yesterday somewhere that these students couldn't comprehend that a white person would be oppressed.
Well, I think there's part of that. You know, there's a fellow named Julius Lester wrote a book. He's an African-American who later converted to Judaism. And he made this comment. He had been involved with radical, on the fringes of radical black movements, which were seen as anti-Semitic. And he made this comment. He said, the thing that most African-Americans don't understand is that Jews don't think they're white. And it was actually a rather profound statement about the sense of outsiderness that Jews carried with them. But the Eastern European Jews that came in waves in the early 20th century from Russia, mm-hmm. they also didn't feel. But these guys that came, the professors, were a lot better educated and a lot better off than most Americans. So.
You have characters in this book that touch both the slavery era and the civil rights movement. And in the middle of all this is the Holocaust, sandwiched in between. And you point out that it was not just black servicemen returning from the war that helped precipitate this civil rights movement that would follow the war. It was increased awareness of injustice. You just talked about that with these double V pins. How big a role do you think among the more learned African-Americans of the time did their exposure to these professors, what kind of a role did that play in increasing that awareness of injustice and the possibility that something could happen?
I don't, it's hard to speak specifically to that, but I can say this in a more general term. The Holocaust revised the century. In other words, World War I made people nuts. People couldn't believe the slaughter. Mm-hmm. And it changed intellectually. It changed all kinds of things. The Holocaust, so frightened. There was a lot of information about it early on, and then people stopped talking about it. It took this country, and I'm Jews and everyone else, 25 to 30 years, to a generation, to even assimilate what had happened. And I, my next book is sort of about that. So it's a very long time. I think people were scared by it.
Yeah.
I think people were terribly frightened about what they saw in these camps.
As an historian, do you worry, because we've heard a lot of criticism about movies taking liberties with truth, so-called historical facts, do you worry that you haven't gotten all the facts right in the novel about the historical part of this? Do you worry that you're painting a picture that's not historically accurate? And does that matter in the setting of a novel?
I think it does. See, I disagree. I know the controversy you're referring to, I think, is around the movie Selma that came out at the time. I think there was a mistake when you have conversations that were recorded by Lyndon Johnson. So we know exactly what Johnson felt because we have the conversations. Mm-hmm. That to change that to make a point is a bad idea. I think you can only historical fiction has to support what we know historically. It can't – you sort of riff on that. But to simply make up something that's contrary to what we know – I think you can't really write a historical novel, say Hitler really liked Jews. He was just having a bad day. You know, so you can't do that. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
So I believe that. Now, the book also, a lot of the book takes place in Paris. My interest there was to compare the two cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So to look at places that were more accepting and less accepting, and what does that mean? Because my bigger question is, are we really more influenced by what's around us? Or by who we are. Ultimately, what makes those decisions for us? Our own personal psychology or the culture around us? I don't have an answer, but that's one of the things I explore in the book.
You go back and forth between writing historical fact, nonfiction books, and fiction. You've written lots of articles about the topics that run the gamut from Joey D and the Starlighters to the IBM ThinkPad to the Woodstock era. How do you choose what to write about?
Well, initially, it was what people were willing to pay me for, as I had more of a choice. If you tend to see what I'm looking at all aspects of the post-war world. Joey Dew and the Starlighters is a very interesting point. It's something that historians like. It's really the beginning of the youth culture, because the people that were going there to dance at the Peppermint Lounge were in their 30s. They were not. It wasn't just kids. So it's a very different. It's a very different moment. Now, Tom Wolfe has made fun of it. I don't see it as so funny. It's really an inflection point, and that's what historians are often looking for.
And you're touching on historical touch points. Right. Is what you're doing. Peter Golden, journalist, historian, and novelist. His latest novel, which deals with these African American colleges rescuing German Jewish professors, is called Wherever There Is Light. If Things Go as Planned, Weather Permitting, he will be signing that book today at 1:30 at Park Road Books. Good luck with you for that.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me, Mike. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Well, there are many famous dance companies in the world, but none more famous or more important than the Dance Theater of Harlem. For nearly 50 years, the company has been thrilling audiences, challenging preconceived notions of what dance and who dancers could be, and making one significant contribution after another to the arts and culture in and out of the African-American community. And as luck would have it, the Dance Theater of Harlem is about to have a very big presence here in Charlotte. First, through performances, which start tonight, I hope, and run through the weekend at the Blumenthal Performing Arts Night Theater, and in an exhibition featuring the history of the company right across the street at the Harvey B. Gantt Center. And today we get a little preview. We are joined by phone by Virginia Johnson, Artistic Director of the Dance Theater of Harlem. She's also a founding member of the company and former principal dancer. She was to be in our studio. I regret to say that we are talking to her by phone because of the weather, but thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Oh, it's my great pleasure to be here.
Tom Gabbert is here in our studio because he lives right around the corner. He's the president and CEO of the Blumenthal Performing Arts Organization. He's also here in our Spirit Square studio. And you'll be also filling in for David Taylor, who is supposed to be with us from the Harvey B. Gantt Center of African American Arts and Culture. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Virginia, for a well-known company, for a company as well-known, as highly regarded as yours, it's a relatively young company. This started in 1969. I actually thought it started in the 40s, but it started in 1969. You were a founding member of the company. Talk about why this company came to be, who started it, and what those first audiences were like.
Of course. So Dance Theatre of Harlem was incorporated in 1969, but it was 1968 that our founder, Arthur Mitchell, was compelled to do something to make his contribution to the situation in America. He was, of course, Arthur Mitchell was the first African-American to be a permanent member of an American ballet company. He was with New York City Ballet, and he had a tremendous career. He'd been asked by the U.S. Government to go down to create a company in Brazil so that we could forge stronger relations between the U.S. and Brazil. And he was on his way to the airport on April 4th, 1968, which is, of course, the day that Dr. King was assassinated. And that really stopped him in his tracks. He wondered why he was going off to some faraway country when there was so much work to be done here. But he also wondered what he could do as a ballet dancer to make a difference. He was very inspired by Dr. King, as we all were. But he saw that Dr. King used his talents, used his knowledge, used his passion to really change the way people thought about who we are as a people and what was happening in this country. So he looked around himself, around the neighborhood where he grew up in Harlem, and he saw a generation or generations of young people who had been written off, who were not considered to be, there was no great future for them. The education system was failing them. There were no jobs. There was no sense of opportunity, no sense of hope. And he thought, aha, I'm going to teach these young people a classical art form, and I'm going to give them a way to change their lives. So he opened the Dance Theatre of Harlem School.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because African Americans in that time period had already made significant contributions to the culture, particularly in music. They had are responsible for jazz. They're responsible for R&B. Motown was a major factor in music in the 1960s. They also made significant contributions in the visual arts, but they were pretty much locked out, except for Arthur Mitchell, of classical ballet. So why did he see this as a way out for these young people?
Well, when Arthur Mitchell decided to open a ballet school in Harlem, he wasn't necessarily thinking about creating ballet dancers. He was thinking about the realization that to address a classical art form or any very rigorous system of learning, you need to have focus, discipline, perseverance. You have to understand that you don't go in there every single day not being able to do it, but working towards this distant goal, and by doing that, you achieve strengths that enable you to achieve that goal. So he really was looking at these young people, giving them a way to achieve success in life, not necessarily to create dancers. One of the things that happened, though, the school was very successful right from the start because Arthur Mitchell remains a charismatic character. He noticed that these young people needed to have something, a goal, a visible goal to move to, someone to look up to, other role models in front of them besides himself. And so he decided to create a company that would give these young people a destination in their dreams. And that's where my story intersects, because I had been a young dancer, grew up in Washington, D.C., had the best training, had a fantastic opportunity, I thought, to become a ballerina, until the director of the school called me in and said, well, you know what, you're a good dancer, and I think that you're going to have a career, but you're never going to be a ballerina because there are no blacks in ballet. So Arthur Mitchell took a group of people like me, and there were, in the first company, there were six other people who found him in Harlem and said, look, we're going to make this happen. And he created Dance Theater of Harlem to let people see that ballet, yes, belongs to everyone, that you need to have the opportunity, you need to have access, but given those things, given the talent, given that preparation that needs to be there, anyone can do this art form.
I want to come back to your personal story in a second, because it really is fascinating and one that would stop a lot of people right there in their tracks, and that would be the end of their careers. But you persevere. But I want to come back to that. The Blumenthal is famous for bringing the Broadway, the touring companies, to town. But you also bring in dance companies and comedians and music groups and solo artists, and you do this all year round. I forgot how many stages you run now. Five, six?
Six.
Six. And there are almost always something on them every day. It's like being in New York almost. But talk to me about the Dance Theater of Harlem, because you've brought in a lot of dance companies over the years. Where would you place Dance Theater of Harlem in on the roster, on the sliding scale?
Certainly, just looking internationally, I certainly would rank them in that top 10. And frankly, it was a surprise to me when I got here 12 years ago to realize that they had not been here, because what Blumenthal is about is bringing the best to Charlotte. And sometimes that's a Broadway show, but as you say, it's also music, dance, and other entertainment. So seeing that they had not been here was something, you know, that was important for us to rectify, because they certainly are among the top 10 artistically, but then also inspirationally. And I think Virginia makes such a passionate statement about the heritage of this company, the way they have inspired young people for generations. And so to make that a part of Charlotte's cultural life was something was important.
And they're here beginning tonight through the 24th at the Knight Theater. Is that correct?
Right. They actually have been here all week. And so we chose an approach, and thankfully with some support from Wells Fargo, the dancers have been working the community all week.
Oh.
And we did a school show yesterday. We were supposed to do a school show today, and unfortunately with the cancellation of schools, had to cancel that. But they have been working hard throughout the community, culminating then in four public performances that begin tonight, two on Saturday and one on Sunday.
We'll keep our fingers crossed for Saturday. Sunday will not be a problem, I don't think. But the Harvey B. Gantt Center is also taking part in all of this with an exhibition that's been traveling around the country called Dance Theater of Harlem, 40 Years of Firsts. The good news here, of course, is that it will be installed there until June, so weather will not be a factor, and you're going to see that. But I understand that neither you nor David Taylor, who's the CEO of Harvey B. Gantt, knew about each other's plans with regard to Dance Theater of Harlem.
We both were interested in connecting with the company and had been working on that, and it was one of those really interesting convergences to realize he was interested in the exhibition, we were interested in bringing the company here, mm-hmm. and the opportunity to put those two together was really too good to be true.
Mm. You know, one of the things, one of the major contributions of the Dance Theater of Harlem is the fact that it opened the eyes of young African Americans who maybe wanted to dance or didn't even know that they wanted to dance, but found out after they saw something, somebody who looked like them on a stage, that they did want to give it a try. If they received proper training, it also meant that they could have a potential career at this. And it also opened the doors, I think, you can tell me whether I'm wrong or not, Virginia, to dancers, African-American dancers taking their place in other companies. I'll get an answer from you on that when we come back from the break, because that seems like a hard slog. It certainly was for a lot of people. So we'll come back and talk about that in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
It's 9:40. You're tuned to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Lisa Wharf. We could see up to half an inch of ice and up to 3 inches of snow and sleet in Charlotte today. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning until 7 p.m. tomorrow. The areas to the north of Charlotte around Lake Norman could see up to 4 inches of snow and sleet, while Hickory and the surrounding area could get between 5 and 9 inches. More than a foot of snow is expected in parts of the mountains. Charlotte Douglas is open today, but check your flight before heading out there. Most have been canceled. And be careful if you have to drive this morning. The snow is sticking to the ground, and there have been some reports of accidents. Support comes from WFAE members and Carpe Diem Restaurant, featuring menus and specifically created for home and stadium tailgate parties. More information available at carpediemrestaurant.com. And continue to stay tuned to WFAE today. We'll have more about the weather, more about cancellations in South Carolina. There is freezing rain also falling at the moment, about 4 inches of snow expected in the Greenville and Spartanburg areas. We'll keep you advised on what's happening out there. Thanks.
Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking in this segment about the Dance Theater of Harlem, which will be in performance tonight, twice on Saturday and again on Sunday at the Knight Theater down on South Tryon Street, right across from the Harvey B. Gantt Center, where an exhibit is underway beginning today called Dance Theater of Harlem, 40 Years of Firsts. Tom Gabbard is in our studio. He's the CEO of Blumenthal Performing Arts. And Virginia Johnson is with us, the artistic director and a founding member of the Dance Theater of Harlem. Arthur Mitchell, your founding choreographer, was a principal dancer, as you said, with the New York City Ballet prior to starting this company. How did he break the barrier? How did he get in?
Well, it's an interesting story. George Balanchine, when he was invited to come to New York to create, to the United States to create a ballet company, Lincoln Kirsten was the person who invited Mr. Balanchine. George Balanchine had the idea that he was going to come here, he was going to create a magnificent new ballet company, and he would have 6 African Americans and 6 white people as part of this company. That was his goal. It's not well known, but George Balanchine worked with Josephine Baker in Paris, and he was really fascinated with this idea of what was possible in terms of movement by using African Americans and white people in a ballet company. Well, you know, that was the 1940s, that was the 1930s. It was not a time that there was any kind of segregation like that happening on the stage. So Mr. Balanchine had to put that dream aside. But when he saw Arthur Mitchell as a very young man, training, he saw the potential in this person to make a statement about what was possible in ballet, that the ballet could look like, could have a different kind of energy and could be much more rich in terms of cultural influence.
So he allowed Arthur Mitchell to break that barrier. Arthur Mitchell was at the New York City Ballet, and you were studying at the Washington School of Ballet in Washington,
right,
D.C., and they were, Mary Day, who ran that company, also, I think, ran the Washington Ballet, which was a major company in that city. And probably still is today. I don't know.
No, she's passed on.
I'm talking about
the company.
The company, absolutely.
The major company.
And she's the one who encouraged you, let you in to this company of dancers, the School of Ballet. You were the only African-American student there. And she's also the one that you talked about a moment ago who said when you got to graduation, she said, well, you can probably go on and have a career in dance, but it won't be in classical ballet because that simply isn't done. Now, why? Arthur Mitchell had already been dancing for the New York City Ballet. Why was it just automatic that you would not have a future in that area?
It's a pretty complicated issue, and it goes to the idea of people, of cultural ownership. And I think that the idea of ballet is as an elitist art form that belongs to a certain group of people, that you have to earn your rights in it, was something that was very much up against the notion of civil rights or the commonality of human beings, whether regardless of what color covers their skin, what is at heart with them. And I think that that's one of the things that Mary Day wrestled with as well. Mary Day had brought in Louis Johnson to choreograph ballets for her Washington Ballet. Louis Johnson is a fantastic African-American choreographer. So I think there's a great deal of conflict, we see it today, between people understanding what's possible and understanding what they are used to.
Well, we see it in the Oscars, don't we?
Absolutely, it is the very same thing. There's an intellectual desire. There's a trained resistance to change, and that's what was behind her statement.
So she
believed in me as a dancer, but she certainly knew that as a business, ballet companies were not hiring black dancers because audiences would not come to see a black dancer.
I find it interesting that thought that you would not have a career in ballet after working so hard to become so good. That thought never crossed your mind until that moment in time. That would have stopped many people from pursuing their dream. But it didn't stop you. And when you finally got to New York and you became part of the company, the Dance Theater Harlem Dance Company, Arthur Mitchell told you that you couldn't dance at all and he'd have to teach you everything. Now, that would have stopped many people right there as well, but you persevered. That must have been devastating, wasn't it?
Boy, you've done your research. It was, but you know what? And this is something that Arthur Mitchell said himself. Somebody tells you you can't do something that you know you can, that you believe in, that you know is yours, you make sure you do it.
Mm.
I knew I was a ballerina. I knew that's what that was the thing that made me, that's why I was here on the earth.
It's an I'll show you. You think
if
I can't, I'll show you.
If I have an obstacle in front of me, that's separating me from that goal, then I've got to find my way around it.
Yeah. Most of us don't have a lot of exposure to dance masters or dance mistresses of dance companies. We only know what we think we know through movies and television, and those are generally not very pretty pictures. Black Swan comes to mind.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But you describe Arthur Mitchell as, and I quote here, very, very, very demanding, very forbidding, and when one interviewer asked you what your relationship to him was like, your answer is pretty telling. You said, he was the man who was going to make it possible for me to do what I wanted to do. What kind of a man is he?
Well, you know, he had a mission. He had a lot to prove. You know, he wanted to show people who didn't believe that blacks should be in ballet that we could be in ballet. He had to show all of us that we could be greater than we even imagined. He had to get, you know, this isn't back in the 1960s, 1970s. He funded this company with his own money. He had to convince corporations and individuals and foundations to back this a black ballet company. What are you talking about? There's no such thing. Why should we do that? So he was a very driven person himself. He created this out of his own will.
Hmm. We're very fortunate, Tom, in this city to have with us, Tom Gabbard is here from the Blumenthal Performing Arts Organization. We had to have with us in our midst the Charlotte Ballet. It's our resident company, and they've done wonderful work and continue to do so. And I know they have their own audience, but you also bring in dance companies from around the country. What kind of an audience does dance have when you put it up against some other forms of entertainment that you bring to town?
I think it's a growing audience. We need to bring more dance here to help expand that audience. But there is a huge appetite for this. I mean, this engagement is basically sold out very quickly. There's this intellectual curiosity I don't think we fully understand here, the appetite for that. Earlier this week, we had a noontime Get to Know the Show program. And in the noon hour, we had over 400 people that were gathered together to learn about Dance Theater of Harlem. We had a business group simultaneously that were hearing from Virginia about the history of the company. There is this intellectual curiosity in this city that I think is remarkable that we need to nurture.
Have you seen the exhibit that's going to be at the Harvey B. Gang?
Yes, I have.
How does it tell the story of the history of the Dance Theater of Harlem?
It's a very inclusive history because 40 years, you can imagine,
yeah.
there is a lot to cover there. The richness of the costumes, I think, artistically have a story in of themselves.
Well, this exhibit is called 40 Years of Firsts, and that is one of the first. It revolves around the costumes because traditionally ballerinas have all been white. And so the costumes were designed to make them look good. You don't necessarily want to put a white tutu in it with pink fringe on an African-American. So he discovered very quickly you should match the costumes to the flesh tones of the dancers, and it made all the difference in the world.
And that is a stunning part of this company's heritage. I mean, I think it's part of the look and feel for the whole experience of going to a Dance Theater of Harlem performance. So, yeah, everyone needs to come see this exhibition. We felt strongly enough about it that we put it together with the performance ticket. So everyone who has a performance ticket automatically got an exhibition ticket. And we just felt it was so compelling that to put the two together was important.
You could move the company to Charlotte. Like Jean-Pierre Bonfou and Patricia McBride's Charlotte Ballet, you perform some of the works of George Balanchine. They do too, along with cutting-edge new works. They do too. And in those new works, it is said that you bring new life to classical ballet. Do you also impart something new to classic works like those of Balanchine, or do you try to stay pure and reproduce what he saw in his head originally?
We see ballet as a living art form. Even if you look at the way that New York City Ballet performs now compared to the way that New York City Ballet performed in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, there's a constant evolution. So we don't try to reflect the past. We want to reflect the integrity and the spirit of the work that, as it was created, but realizing that we're living in a time in which energies are different, when perceptions are different. We want ballet to be this art form that people can relate to now.
And you say that you use the vocabulary of classical ballet, but you infuse it with humanity.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I feel very deeply concerned about when we speak about classical ballet is that it's becoming rarefied to the point that we can't connect to it. We are human beings using this language to communicate. It is simply a language. We need to use it. We need to be true to its rigors, but we need to use it as a living instrument.
I guess a good example of taking classical ballet and relating it to a contemporary audience started with Arthur Mitchell. I'm told that when he first was pitching the idea of opening the school, he went to African-American schools around New York City, and he would stand on the stage and do a little demonstration to try to whet their appetites for coming to the school. And the very first one he did, because he was a ballet dancer, he did in tights. And tell me the story. He kind of got – people were snickering at him, and so he's never done that since. Is that right?
Right. You know, the dancers wear tights, but he comes out on the stage as a man. You know, he comes out in slacks and a nice shirt, and he doesn't do them any longer. But our ballet master, Keith Saunders, you know, he comes out as this this male force on the stage, and people are not distracted by a man in tights because people – do get distracted by men.
Yes, they do. You actually wanted to bring the Dance Theater of Harlem here earlier, but they, like many other arts organizations, fell on hard times. You actually shut the company down for a year that lasted from 2004 to 2013. That's a long year. And you wanted to make sure that they were back on their artistic footing, which obviously they are. What did it take, Virginia, to bring that company back after such a layoff?
So this is a new generation of dancers. You know, in that period of time, in that length of time, dancers have a very short career. So many of the dancers who were at the top of their form at that point were no longer performing. So we had to identify a new group of dancers. But the most important thing about bringing this company back for this time period was to realize that we are living in a very different world. We're living in a post-2008 world. The economics of making a ballet company have never made sense. So we needed to look at how to create a model that was sustainable, that would enable us to be the touring company that we must be so that we could survive. That meant that in 2004, when we put the company on hiatus, there were 46 dancers. We have 14 dancers here in Charlotte. Our repertoire is as strong and as vibrant as it was before, but we don't have large-scale ballets such as Firebird or Creole Giselle that require a set, that require us to travel with sceneries and costumes in a truck. So it's a way of being very lean, very efficient, but continuing to take this artistic message forward.
There still aren't, even after all this time, there still aren't enough opportunities, it would seem to me, for African-American dancers or people of color to be in a classical ballet company, and yet you don't limit your performance group to simply African-American dancers. You have people of other ethnicities in the company as well. given the dearth of opportunity for black dancers, why? Why not just keep it that way?
We never were intended to be a black ballet company. Okay. That's not what Arthur Mitchell set out to do. That's not what we're about. We are about diversity. We are about opening people's perceptions in terms of who belongs on the ballet stage, but it was never about being exclusively black. I think that I can finally say that this is changing across the board. In Denver this weekend, the International Association of Blacks in Dance has organized a ballet audition for women of color. And there are 24 artistic directors who hopefully will be able to gather in Denver on Sunday to see these young people, because now there is a tremendous interest in diversifying the ballet stage. You know, I understand that part of it is an intellectual interest, or part of it is a perhaps marketing interest. Oh, I'm very cynical when I say that. But I also understand that we are changing as a country, and these are the things that are showing it.
Well, it would also seem to be that if you want to broaden your audience and make sure that there's an audience, ongoing audience for a classical ballet, you have to reflect the people who are available to be in your audience. Is that not true?
Exactly. You know, we have a wonderful partnership with the Charlotte Ballet, in which students from our training program come in, are selected by Jean-Pierre to come into the school, into the training program at the second company at Charlotte Ballet. So there have been little bubblings up across the country of ways to diversify ballet companies. The thing that is still unresolved and needs to be resolved is, what is the image of classical ballet? Is it that pale stick figure who doesn't even look human? Or is it indeed a human being who can do superhuman things?
And you're going on with the show tonight. Rain or shine, snow or sleet, is that what's happening?
We are. All of our shows, we have Wicked playing, we have Potted Sherlock, they're all on tonight. And also on is a lecture tomorrow. Virginia's going to be speaking at the Gantt Center at noon tomorrow. That is on as well.
Okay. Tom Gabbert, President and CEO of the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center, and the center is no longer part of that. Blumenthal Performing Arts. And Virginia Johnson, Artistic Director and Founding Member of the Dance Theater of Harlem. They perform tonight through the weekend at the Knight Theater, blumenthalarts.org, for information about that. And the exhibit, Dance Theater of Harlem, 40 Years of First, opens tonight and continues through June at the Harvey B. Gantt Center. Thank you both for being here.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.